important that we are able to increase our maritime domain awareness so we know what's going on in the Bering Strait.
The Coast Guard opens its first forward operating location in Kotzebue. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Monday, July 15th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, the federal government may look into taking the humpback whale off the endangered species list.
There's probably 8 to 10 whales that I could just look at and say, that's Willie, or that's Sasha, or that's Sheila.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. Join Alaska bars and restaurants from every corner of the state in taking a stand against secondhand smoke. The fact of the matter is, no Alaskan, employee, or customer should suffer the heart disease and lung cancer due to secondhand smoke. The benefits are undeniably positive for Alaskans and for the bottom line. Clean indoor air. It's good for health, and it's great for business. For more information on smoke-free workplaces, visit alaskatca.org. This message sponsored by the Alaska Tobacco Control Alliance.
The U.S. Coast Guard opened its forward operating location in Kotzebue last week as part of Arctic Shield 2013. Though this year's operation is focused on Western Alaska, the Coast Guard aims to build on knowledge gained during last year's operation in the Arctic, where personnel and equipment were based in Barrow. Kip Wadlow is a spokesman for the 17th U.S. Coast Guard District in Juneau.
It's important that we are able to increase our maritime domain awareness so we know what's going on in the Bering Strait. So if a accident or a disaster occurs, you know, we are prepared to work with our international and local partners to respond to that.
During Arctic Shield 2013, the Coast Guard will focus on outreach in Western Alaska, testing its Arctic capabilities, and working in conjunction with the Canadian Coast Guard to help build on its international partnership with Canada. Wadlow says one difference between this and last year's operation is the testing of the Coast Guard cutter Nishan.
What makes this important is that it is the first time that a Coast Guard 110-foot patrol boat has ever deployed that far north. So it is it's going to provide the Coast Guard with a great opportunity to test the capabilities of that asset so we can better understand what it's going to take for future cutters to operate in the area.
The forward operating location will remain open through the end of September. Is the North Pacific humpback whale no longer endangered? The National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration will decide soon whether to pursue taking the whale off the endangered species list. A group of Hawaiian fishermen submitted a petition to delist humpbacks in April, and the agency will determine if it has enough credible information for further review. Removing the North Pacific humpback from the endangered species list would require NOAA to revisit an important regulation specific to watching humpback whales in Alaska waters. As KTOO's Lisa Fu reports, the rapid growth of Juneau's whale-watching industry may be causing some vessels to overlook regulations and guidelines.
There's probably 8 to 10 whales that I could just look at and say, that's Willie, or that's Sasha, or that's Sheila.
Larry Dupler, better known as Captain Larry, started conducting whale watching trips with Dolphin Tours in 1994, when there were only a handful of local companies on the water.
Sasha has the scar across her back and down her right side and on her back.
Dupler helped start Orca Enterprises in 1997 and has been with the company ever since.
Some of these whales I know, and I know they know me, almost have a personal relationship with some of them.
He says not all captains feel the same way.
If you watch the way some of the captains handle their boats around the animals, they're not worried about the animal itself. They're more worried about their customers and making them happy, getting them a good show, and some of them even violate the guidelines and regulations that we have in place.
By 2001, it was clear to NOAA that humpbacks in Alaska were particularly vulnerable to pressure and potential harm from increased vessel traffic and whale watching. The Protected Resources Division came up with the 100-yard rule, making it unlawful to approach within 100 yards of a humpback whale in Alaska waters. While establishing the regulation, NOAA considered a permitting system for the whale-watching industry, but concluded it didn't have sufficient infrastructure. No permitting system exists for vessels that want to enter the industry. Weather permitting owner and captain Greg Brown says whale watching should be more tightly regulated.
There is a lot of abuse and a lot of whales getting run over and pressured that can be avoided if we change the rules a little bit.
NOAA's Enforcement Division received 42 reports of harassment to humpbacks statewide in 2012. While the agency has patrol boats, including one in the greater Juneau area, most complaints come from the general public.
We really encourage everyone to consider themselves a steward of this animal.
Marine mammal specialist Ilaria Jensen says humpbacks are in Alaska May through September, and most spend the rest of the year in Hawaii.
Alaska is the kitchen. It's completely the time for foraging, for feeding, for bulking up.
She says regulations and guidelines are meant to limit disturbance to the whale's natural behavior. Gauging 100-yard distance for whale watching requires training. Allen Marine Tours, for example, has a rangefinder on every boat, according to Juneau General Manager Eric Majeski.
In the training week, we'll go out to an island or a reef, somewhere where we can have a hard surface to get a digital reading from, and have all the captains stand at the helm and see how far away that is. They can use every tool if they can to make sure they're staying at least 100 yards away.
Allen Marine started offering whale watching tours in 1995.
We started off with just 3 boats, and now we're up to 13 boats based out of Juneau.
NOAA Enforcement Division Special Agent Ron Antea says the number of humpback harassment complaints has not varied over the years, despite the growing number of tour boats. He believes the industry polices itself.
Given the volume of tour activity out there and the volume of complaints we get, I think that speaks for itself. They're doing a pretty darn good job.
Last month, NOAA fined Alaska Yacht Charters $5,000 for coming within 30 feet of a pod of breaching whales in 2010. The company's owner, Jeffrey Wilson, was found liable under the Marine Mammal Protection Act and the Endangered Species Act. NOAA will look at abundance trends as it considers the petition to delist. Alaska Fisheries Science Center Director Doug DeMaster says the number of North Pacific humpback whales has increased.
We went from what may have been as few as 1,000 or so animals in the 1960s to more than 20,000 humpback whales today.
Orca Enterprises Dupler worries the industry has grown past the point of saturation.
Today there's like 3 or 4 humpbacks in the general area, and it's not uncommon now to go out and see 15 to 20 some boats sitting around one animal.
Thank you.
The Alaska Visitor Statistics Program indicates more than 50% of visitors engage in wildlife viewing, including whale watching, making it one of the most popular tourist activities in the state. In Juneau, I'm Lisa Fu.
In a half-hour meeting yesterday afternoon, the Alaska Redistricting Board unanimously agreed on a new electoral map. The process of drawing the state's political boundaries has been going on for nearly 3 years. Along the way, board members described it as a struggle. Democrats characterized it as gerrymandering by a Republican-dominated group, and the courts deemed it unconstitutional. Board member Bob Brody expressed relief at the idea that Sunday's meeting could be the board's last.
It wasn't an easy job in the beginning, and it wasn't any easier later.
The new plan is partially based on a proposal from the Native Corporation Chilista, and there are some major changes from the temporary map used in the 2012 election. It gets rid of a controversial district that mixed some Fairbanks area residents with rural Alaska. It removes Petersburg from Juneau's Senate district, and it reconnects the Aleutian chain. All of those issues had been raised as constitutional problems in ongoing litigation. During yesterday's meeting, board members complimented each other on finalizing a new map, and they discussed the challenges of complying with both the Alaska Constitution and the Federal Voting Rights Act. The act, which is meant to protect the influence of minority populations, was partially struck down by the U.S. Supreme Court last month. Board member Jim Holmes spoke critically of giving special treatment to Native voters.
I find it to be very disconcerting that we so many times try to allow people to have extra voting rights versus people who are just plain Alaskans. I've been here 67 years and I'm an Alaskan. I may not be an Alaskan Native, but I'm a Native Alaskan.
The map will now be reviewed by the courts to determine whether it complies with state law. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, a new book digs into the sordid life of Papa Pilgrim in Alaska.
Once I rode horses out to their homestead and visited them, it turned into a much bigger story.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. The Medallion Foundation and the Federal Aviation Administration set standards for the operation of aircraft and airports and provide services to the flying public. Passengers are influential in making flying safer in Alaska. When passengers know their rights and responsibilities, aviation is safer for everyone. Safety information online at faa.gov/go/flyalaska. This message is sponsored by the Medallion Foundation.
Hundreds of people gathered at the Rediski Air Hangar in Nikiski on Saturday afternoon to remember and celebrate the life of Walter Rediski. He was killed in the July 7th plane crash at the Soldotna Airport. He was 42 years old. KBBI's Ariel Van Cleve attended the gathering and brought back this remembrance.
Friends and family called him Willie. He was hardworking, compassionate, calm, and devout. Those that were sharing stories during the service said he had the ability to make you feel special and was always ready to lend a helping hand. That afternoon, everyone was silent as they watched a slideshow that featured pictures and home movies. His Aunt Colleen says she was glad to see how many lives he touched and how clearly beloved he was in his community.
It is your love and respect for Willie that you are pouring out to the rest of us. And we are so appreciative. And you know, we have a large family, but by the time we include all of you in it, we're going to be too numerous to count.
Willie grew up in Nikiski. His family said he married the love of his life, Mary, and the two had three children. He took over Rediski Air after his father passed away. They started out with just one plane, but Willie grew the business. Jake Sanders says his family and the Rediskis go way back. Willie was there the day he was born, and he considered him to be almost like an older brother. Sanders worked for Rediski Air at various times over the last 9 years and told the crowd a story from his first few months with the company. He was backing the charter's plane into the hangar and scratched up the wing of a fellow pilot's plane. Sanders says Willie calmly buffed out the scratch and left it at that. He says anyone else would have been furious.
Not Willie, just calm, took it all in stride. You know, and that was him. I mean, so stories that we all have about how calm and relaxed he was, it makes him so unique, you know, just kind of shows the man he was.
Sanders says Willie was always there to take care of you. Keith Gerke knew both Willie and his father. At the end of the service, he was standing beside an older model red Dodge Ram with a bouquet of white and red flowers sitting on the hood. Gerke described Willie as level-headed and kind. He says Willie was living out the dream for both himself and his father, and that both lives were cut too short.
I live close by here, and the flight paths of the local charter outfits right over my house, so I think of both men.
In Homer, I'm Ariel Van Cleve.
A state antitrust lawyer says a proposed merger may pit the commercial shipping equivalents of David against Goliath in southeast Alaska. The plan, announced in April, involves three shipping companies, Seattle-based Alaska Marine Lines, Seattle-based Northland Services, and Sitka-based Samson Tug and Barge. KTOO's Jeremy Shea has more.
AML's parent company, Linden Incorporated, wants to buy AML competitor Northland Services. If that was the end of the plan, Linden would have a monopoly on shipping in southeast Alaska.
Competing with someone like Linden's a tough thing to do.
That's Assistant Attorney General Ed Sniffen speaking to the Juneau Chamber of Commerce on Thursday. It's his job to review the merger plan, negotiate fixes to the anti-competitive parts, and if necessary, fight it out in court.
I mean, they've been around, they're big, they know what they're doing. You get someone like, Samson coming in and, you know, trying to swing at Goliath a little bit, and you want to make sure they have a big hammer. So when they hit him, he feels it.
Though Sitka-based, Samson right now doesn't operate elsewhere in Southeast. Samson Vice President Corey Baggin says the company only has about 10 employees in the Panhandle, all of them in Sitka. However, Samson announced plans to expand its service in Southeast the same day Linden announced its intent to buy Northland. AML has been touting that expansion as the antidote to its Southeast monopoly. Here's AML President Kevin Anderson.
I think that the competition is going to be as stiff as it is today with Northland, and normally competition tends to keep the prices down. We're not going into this thinking we're going to lose any customers, and if we have the battle for them to keep them, so be it.
Many details of the vetting and deal-making are under wraps, at least until the Department of Law files something in court, but the parties have essentially said that Northland won't be wholly absorbed by Linden. Instead, Northland may be carved up between Linden and Sampson in service of the smaller company's southeast expansion. For example, Baggin said Sampson is eyeing Northland's current location on Channel Drive as its future port in Juneau. And if everything goes forward, she says her company will probably pick up 40 or 50 of Northland's employees in southeast. That last if brings it back to the Department of Law. Baggin says Sampson won't start investing and expanding until the merger's greenlit. But the merger may not be greenlit until AML actually has new competition in southeast.
I don't want to set it up and put a warehouse in with 25 doors and be all ready for nothing and the consent decree doesn't go through. So it's kind of a chicken egg thing right now.
AML's Kevin Anderson says his company's intent with the purchase of Northland is not to monopolize shipping in Southeast, but to expand in Seattle by acquiring Northland's property there and to become a full-service Alaska seafood packager, carrier, and marketer.
The thing that Northland does extremely well is that they're out in the West, Bristol Bay and Kodiak and Dutch Harbor. I mean, some of the biggest fish runs in all of Alaska. We couldn't play in that game.
He also says it's been an extremely painful process.
We've been involved in this process now for, I don't know, close to a year. And it doesn't seem like we're getting any closer. It's just one thing after another, and the amount of time and effort it takes on a lot of people's part to put something like this together is unbelievable.
Sniffen says the Department of Law hopes to have something filed in October, which would open a 60-day public comment period. Ultimately, a judge would have to sign off on the deal. If the department can meet that timeline, Sniffen says the parties would know by the new year if the merger can go through. As far as her company's characterization as David, Baggin was lukewarm.
I think that the history of Southeast Alaska has shown that small companies can be viable and successful and can do a really good job here. So even though it might be a good analogy, I think it's okay.
That history includes echoes of another David and Goliath story. When Linden, originally a trucking company, first got into Alaska shipping, Anderson says Linden wasn't taken seriously because Foss Maritime was the giant. Reporting in Juneau, I'm Jeremy Shea.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Providence Imaging Center, helping cancer patients stay in Anchorage with a PET scanner that fuses anatomical and functional images since 2004. Learn more at provimaging.com. How do you get men to wear a life jacket when the fact is that 90% of those who die in boating accidents in Alaska are men? Well, most men won't listen to this message, but they might listen to you. So have them pledge to wear a life jacket every time they get in a boat. Every time. Have them fill out a Pledge to Live card at pledgetolive.org. That's pledgetolive.org. Make them promise so they make it back home. This message sponsored by the Alaska Office of Boating Safety.
2 years ago, historian Penelope Goforth discovered six ledgers from the Alaska Commercial Company gathering dust in a friend's basement. Now, as KUCB's Audrey Carlson reports, she's using the lost ledgers to bring a distant chapter of Aleutian history to life.
The Alaska Commercial Company dominated the fur trade in the Aleutians during the late 1800s. Trading station agents used ledger books to keep careful records of business transactions and correspondences. But Penelope Goforth says that the agents didn't limit their writing to just business.
He also noted things happening in the community. If somebody was born, if somebody was married, if someone passed away, you know, all of these different events.
Goforth's lost ledgers offer a rare glimpse into life in the Aleutians in the early years of American settlement. Goforth transcribed the contents of the ledgers for a multimedia project last year and recalls several entries.
Men from Kashiga arrived today. Atchikan people came and visited. On Alaska, people couldn't leave today. Too much surf on the beach.
When taken together, the individual entries tell a story. Goforth says she wants to use them to paint a vivid picture of Aleutian life for a broader audience. And to do that, she's going old school.
There's something about a book. You know, you just have to put it into a book.
While the book is going to rely heavily on information gleaned from the ledgers, it won't actually be about the Alaska Commercial Company. Instead, Goforth says she's focusing on how an influx of foreigners changed the Unangan way of life. Ultimately, she wants her book to help younger generations of Unangan better understand their rich history and culture, including the day-to-day happenings that defined life during that time.
The next chapter that I'm working on is going to be really fun. It is a cash account of everybody's purchases at the Alaska Commercial Company store. There was a little kerfluffle, as it were, about the price of mustard at one point. I won't say more about that until you read the book.
When that might be possible is still up in the air. Goforth hasn't found a publisher yet, but she has received a $5,000 grant from the Alaska Humanities Forum for her project and hopes to be done with the first draft by the end of the year. In Unalaska, I'm Audrey Carlson.
A new book by longtime Alaska journalist Tom Kazaya hits bookstores tomorrow. Pilgrim's Wilderness, a true story of faith and madness on the Alaska frontier, details the story of Robert Allen Hale, better known to Alaskans as Papa Pilgrim, who for years terrorized his family in the remote mountains of Wrangell-St. Elias National Park. KBBI's Aaron Selbig reports.
Well, it's the story of a wilderness family that had turned into a kind of family cult.
Journalist Tom Kazaya knows the story perhaps better than anyone, having reported on the Pilgrim family for the Anchorage Daily News going back to 2002, when Robert Allen Hale, or Papa Pilgrim, was engaged in a very public fight against the National Park Service over access to his remote land in Wrangell-St. Elias National Park.
You know, it started out with the story of a bulldozer running through the national park, and that was one of the perennial stories of being a reporter in Alaska, that, you know, the sort of the 19th century renegade running into modern environmental ethics and the kind of fussy management of wilderness that the national parks have brought. But then after I had talked to the father who was calling himself Papa Pilgrim over the phone, I thought, wow, this is a pretty interesting family. I'd like to go out and meet them. And of course, once I rode horses out to their homestead and visited them, it turned into a much bigger story than about the bulldozer itself.
While Papa Pilgrim waged his war against the Park Service and became a sort of folk hero to some because of it, Kazaya was able to gain access to the family. It helped that Kazaya's own family owned a cabin near McCarthy, not far from the Pilgrim homestead, and Kazaya says that as much as he may have been using Robert Hale to get to the fascinating story of this isolated family, he thinks Hale was also using him to drum up public support in his fight over land use rights. After many visits to the Pilgrim homestead over a period of many months, Kazaya says it became apparent that something wasn't quite right.
When Papa was just describing how he kept the kids insulated from any outside influence, you go, okay, maybe that's cool, I don't know. And just other weird things, like when he said, you know, he was presenting these kids as children of nature, and in many ways they were, and yet he said that they had never bathed without being in their clothes, that they always bathed in their clothes. And I would sort of look over at my photographer who was out there with me, and you were kind of pinching yourself a little bit.
Kazaya had no idea at the time, of course, that Robert Hale was terrorizing his family, including beating and sexually assaulting his wife and at least one of his daughters. Those horrific details would not become public until Hale's trial in 2007.
Today, the man who calls himself Papa Pilgrim is sentenced for his crimes against his very own family.
Hale pled no contest to 30 charges, including sexual abuse, incest, kidnapping, and coercion. He received a maximum sentence of 25 years in prison, but died less than a year later. Pilgrim's Wilderness has many twists and subplots, including a hard look at the relationship between journalists and their sources, and some very careful research of Robert Hale's past. Hale grew up in Texas, where his father was a football hero and later an FBI agent. Hale has connections to the assassination of John F. Kennedy, including an arrest for breaking into the apartment of Kennedy's alleged mistress, and then later eloping with the daughter of Texas Governor John Connally, who was in the car with Kennedy in Dallas and was wounded during the assassination. The plot thickens even more when Hale's young wife, Kathleen Connolly, is shot to death in their Florida home under mysterious circumstances, a crime that was never solved. Keziah says that Hale's journey took him from Texas through a tour of 1960s counterculture in San Francisco to South America, where he rode on horseback while using LSD, to the remote mountains of New Mexico.
And it was only quite a bit later, when he had gotten together with the woman who became his wife, Country Rose, when he had a kind of conversion experience and cut his hair and threw away all his marijuana and peyote and became fervent Bible reader.
Ultimately, Keziah's story is one of salvation, about how the 15 members of the Hale family were eventually able to escape the wilderness and their violent, tyrannical patriarch. He says the family owes much to another family, the Buckinghams, who took them into their Palmer home when the Hales were at their lowest point. Here the two families are together in a 2007 YouTube video singing the hymn, "It Is Well With My Soul."
First, the brothers escaped quietly, and then, in a very dramatic moment, the two oldest daughters got on a snow machine and tore off into the wilderness while their father was away in town. As they were making their escape, they had brought along two white sheets, and they pulled the sheets over them in the snow and waited as their father was coming up the trail, hoping he wouldn't see them and that they could make their getaway.
It wasn't until after the trial and death of Robert Hale that Keziah was sure that he wanted to write Pilgrim's Wilderness. The process took 3 years. Keziah's publisher, Crown Publishing Group, is billing the book as Helter Skelter Meets Into the Wild, and Keziah says that description is not far off the mark. Pilgrim's Wilderness officially hits bookstore shelves Tuesday. Reporting from Homer, I'm Aaron Selbig.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org, and you can follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Lisa Fu and Jeremy Shea in Juneau, Ariel Van Cleve and Aaron Selbig in Homer, and Audrey Carlson in Unalaska. APRN's Alexandra Gutierrez reported from Juneau. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Josh Edge is our web producer, and I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by BP, supporting public broadcasting in Alaska. The Alaska Nanook Commission reminds you that harassing polar bears or taking polar bears with cubs is not only illegal, but it is not part of Native traditions. Together with their management partners at the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, the Alaska Nanook Commission has been working on developing a long-term polar bear deterrence plan to protect Alaska's villages from dangerous polar bear encounters. More at the AlaskaNanookCommission.org. This message sponsored by the Alaska Nanook Commission, Alaska's people managing Alaska's resources. The Medallion Foundation and Federal Aviation Administration set standards for the operation of aircraft and airports. More information at faa.gov/go/flyalaska. This message is sponsored by the Medallion Foundation.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.